Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is, once again, the GNE Navigator, John Lash, recording on the 6th of January, 2014. This is Nav Briefing number 101, The Will to Avenge. To kick off this briefing, I'd like to bring you up to date on the current navigational parameters, including the moon cycle, the upcoming apogee and perigee moments, and so forth. Today is the fifth day of the cycle of Kalima, or Maha Kali. She has at least 1,000 names. So it so happens that her shift begins on the 2nd of January, and the fifth day, which is a Fibonacci number, corresponds to the 6th of January, traditionally celebrated as Epiphany. And here in Spain and other parts of Europe, it's celebrated as the Day of the Three Kings. You know, some people who look back into ancient history have tried to legitimate and glorify the biblical story of the Nativity in various ways. The most common way is to claim that there are pagan elements of symbolism hidden in the Jesus narrative, and by digging out and exposing these elements, well, I don't know. I guess that is supposed to give the narrative some legitimacy or to invest it with some esoteric depth which it would otherwise not have. Unfortunately, even when these expositions of this type, such as you find in Freakin' Gandhi, the Jesus Mysteries, even when they have the overt purpose of debunking or discrediting Christianity by pointing to its non-Christian origins, the effect is often the opposite, and there is a re-legitimation of the Christian narrative and the Jesus nativity story as if it were something that was born out of the mysteries, which it certainly is not. So one of the key factors that naive and insufficiently informed researchers have highlighted is the presence of the Magi, or the three kings, in the Nativity scene. Of course, the Magi could easily be traced back to the Magian order, couldn't they? As I've said on metahistory.org, the Magian order, which was founded on the Urmian Plateau in northwestern Iran around 6000 BC, is the ancient taproot of the Gnostic movement. So were the three kings who appeared to the infant Jesus in the stable actually representatives of the Magian order, a.k.a. Gnostics, a.k.a. Teleste of the Mystery Schools? Well, you get my drift, you know. And if someone says that they were, then there is a connection between the ancient mysteries and the Nativity scene, which gives legitimation to that scene, unfortunately. Also, it's easy to make such inferences, because it is widely known that the Magians, who are also called Sabians, were stargazers. Well, somebody was watching the stars in order to determine that event which has been called the Star of Bethlehem, which most likely occurred in 6 BC and has been identified accurately, I believe, with a conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn in the constellation of the Fishes. Well, the Magians slash Gnostics, or children of Seth, were the greatest stargazers and sky diviners of the ancient world in the ancient Middle East. So, did they see or predict or foretell the coming of the Jesus Messiah by reading the skies, and then did they henceforth know how to appear at that moment? You see, all of this is fabulation and retrofitting. To me, it's no more than trying to save a ruined souffle by turning it into scrambled eggs. So it's unfortunate that people do this, but until the whole messianic archetype and the psychopathology of messianic narcissism collapses, which may well happen in correction, until then, there are millions and millions of people who will want to turn that souffle of the Jesus narrative into an omelet. And my advice to those of you who are listening to this commentary given on the day of Epiphany, when the three kings appeared, and also supposedly corresponding to the baptism of Jesus by John some 30 years later, those of you who are listening to me at this moment, I advise you to don't waste your precious time going back into those ancient materials unless you really know the forensics required to assess them correctly. And I can assure you that the mastery of those forensic techniques is a great challenge and takes an entire lifetime. So to continue now in my usual kind and genial fashion, let me give you the picture for the month of January 2014. The Kali shift begins on Thursday the 2nd. Now, I am informed by a crew member who observed the crescent moon at the earliest possible moment, should have been on the 3rd, when it stood in the empty space and asked me how to call the shift. And I said, even if the moon were glimpsed at the earliest possible moment, when it had not shifted into the stars marking the composite of the goatfish, still, positioned in the empty space, it would have been technically, and here is the graphic mythopoetic syntax, before the gaze of the goatfish. The goatfish gazes down into the empty space, which, as you know, is the zone representing the loss of humanity. So the call of the shift would still go to Kalima, represented by the goatfish. The shift ends on the 30th of January with a new moon, which is invisible, of course, but you can picture it in 3 degrees of Aquarius, and that puts it exactly in the forehead of the goatfish. I think we can anticipate a rather dramatic moment at the end of this shift, and I would expect that the last 5 days in completion with Kalima would produce some extremely intense realizations among those of you who follow this method, and maybe even some of you who don't. And I would also anticipate some flagrant and dramatic events in the outer world reflecting how Kalima comes on like gangbusters. During this month, there is an apogee surge on the 16th in 25 degrees of Cancer, that is, in the face of the twins. And then, of course, interestingly, there is a perigee surge on the final day of the shift. So when the moon stands in the forehead of the goatfish, it will also be standing at its perigee at new moon between the earth and the sun, but it will be invisible. Nevertheless, although it is invisible, it will be close to the earth at that moment. the closest it passes in the entire monthly cycle. You get the picture. I'll have you note that in anticipation of this briefing, I posted an illustration on Gaiaspora.org, and if you click on it, it comes up larger, and you see that it is a poster that reads like this. Hurt the mother, the wounds she'll take, but hurt the child, and Kali awakes. I would modify the poetry a little. Hurt the mother, the wounds she can take, but hurt the child, and see Kali awake. Kali Ma, coming to a social theater near you soon. The relevance of that poster ought to become clear in the course of this briefing. Final point I want to make is the disappearance of Black Jaguar as of just lately, in case you didn't happen to notice. Remember that from the 12th of December to the 20th, in those crucial 8 days, and they were certainly crucial days in my life, Black Jaguar, Shibalanke, turned in her tracks, first looking back, frozen, then turning back. And I would point out that when she turns back and reverses her movement, her action is one of great stealth and of startling rapidity. And so we've been used to watching Venus in the evening sky ever since I posted the briefing, Black Jaguar Rising. Then we had the warning that she was going to pass between the Earth and the Sun, which causes her to disappear from observation, and how quickly this happened, and how quickly now she descends into the underworld. And on the 11th of January, Venus stands between the Earth and the Sun. This is called inferior conjunction, and the location of it is in 21 Capricorn, which is still in the empty space. We have to jump ahead until around the 2nd of February, which would be the first day of spring. At that time, Venus turns direct again. That is the moment of her rising from the underworld, February 2nd. And if you are lucky to have a low horizon toward the east, you would see Venus there in the morning sky before dawn, located just above the shoulder of the Archer. So those are the current events of most relevance to us right now. And regarding affinities and synchronicities and synchro-mystical correspondences to those events, I'd like to point out two items quickly. First of all, I received, I think beginning in late November and throughout the month of December, at least 12 different links, or 12 links from different people, cluing me to the YouTube clip about the animal communicator. This little story, which is about 12 or 14 minutes long, concerns a refuge for predatory felines in Africa, and the star of the story is one particularly savagely gorgeous black panther, originally named Diablo, but later named Spirit. I think they could have chosen something a little more imaginative and a little more mythopoetic. Anyway, there is the Black Jaguar appearing in a YouTube clip, which, as far as I can see, went viral during the month of December at the very moment that Black Jaguar turned in her tracks. Isn't that remarkable? I don't know when that clip originally appeared. I haven't checked the timestamps for the earliest appearance, its earliest appearance on YouTube, but it certainly was circulated massively at exactly at the moment that we in the GNE were observing Shibalanke, the celestial black jaguar. I'd also like to point out that I received a message in the Navigator mailbag dated December 3rd, which happens to be the Nav's birthday, you may know. The message written on that day comes from crew member Julie, who wrote, "This morning I saw my first puma in the flesh. I travel rural roads and one ran across in front of me. I was in a car. Initially, I could not tell what it was. One, because it was absolutely startling, and two, I have never seen one run. Their speed is almost supernatural. Actually, it is supernatural. They are like lightning. I instantly knew this is something special." End quote. Well, Julie had the good fortune, I don't know where she lives, that she's able to see pumas in the wild or running across roads, but she had the good fortune of observing the speed of those animals. And we, who have been observing the sky, likewise, had that good fortune. I was still observing Venus low on the horizon as we came around the bend into 2014. But then, presto, a certain moment, a certain evening, and she is gone. Isn't it remarkable how this mythopoetic method works? And when it works in a fabulous manner. I want to assure you, my friends, that I've dedicated my life to the study of how it works. And with the GNE, I'm in the process of learning and demonstrating it as you yourselves are demonstrating it in your lives, singly and with each other. And I assure you that there is no limit to the magic and beauty that can be generated and manifested by this method. For a final prefatory remark, I'd like to point out that the kind of phenomenon I'm describing here, the interface between imagination and reality, imagination and events, the interface between sky and mind, the timing of celestial events related to realizations and emergent fields of concern in the human endopsyche, and so forth and so on. All of this could be subsumed under the label of synchromysticism. I don't know if any of you know this term, but synchromysticism is a widely used term in pop culture. It's described as a portmanteau of the words synchronicity and mysticism. And it is described in this way. Synchromysticism, the vast and noble undertaking of piecing together the occult holographic language system of the universe in order to identify and more aptly understand the relationship between the collective consciousness of all sentient beings on Earth and beyond. And that little quote is one attributed to a gentleman named Steve Wilner. Now, if you search synchromysticism, you come up with an enormous amount of material, plus forums in which people, groups of people, are rapidly observing synchromystical events, correspondences, eventualities, intrapsychic and extrapsychic phenomena of all kinds. In other words, it's a hot meme with the internet crowd and the youth culture who use the internet as their main medium of learning and communication. Okay, so far so good. I have no objection to that whatsoever. In fact, I'm delighted that young people with bright and inquiring minds are investigating the realm of synchromysticism. Who knows? Some of them may find their way to the Channel 16 event, and they might take a look at the Channel 16 forum, which presents the testimony of people who are engaged in an exercise of synchro mysticism, specifically designed to test and apply, to discover, test and apply the telepathic capacities of the human animal. I would point out that synchro mysticism is a vast subject that could go in many different directions. And if you care to consider the synchro mysticism operating within the method of the GNE, that is to say, creative mythology after Joseph Campbell, then you would find that all the elements are there, plus a coherence and a direction that might not be present in the general and loose exploration of synchro mysticism. That investigation could be like sailing without a compass and allowing the mind and the psyche to be entrained any which way and in any direction whatsoever, or even in different directions at once, due to the lack of that compass. You could define the GNE as synchro mysticism aimed, if I might be so bold as to say so. After all, what are you going to learn from the investigation of synchro mysticism? What is your objective? What is the ultimate goal? Suppose, for instance, that you learned how the human endopsyche works, that is to say, the collective subconscious of the human species, and how a single human animal could apply some forces upon the endopsyche, let's say through the power of suggestion, subconscious suggestion, or maybe even a kind of post-hypnotic effect. If some individual could magically apply that by discovering laws of the endopsyche through the study of synchromysticism, then that individual would be in a position to direct and manipulate vast numbers of human beings through the mechanisms of the endopsyche. Well, it's entirely possible that a deep study of synchromysticism might lead to insights that would favor that application. But what then is the agenda for that application? What would you as an individual do if you had that power? You see, the synchromysticism operating in the GNE and in Planetary Tantra already has a transpersonal direction. It's given aim and direction by the sacred narrative, which is objective and transpersonal and common to all participants. Furthermore, to go back to that definition, in Planetary Tantra, it's not merely a matter of exploring the occult holographic language system of the universe, but specifically of exploring and mastering the syntax of planetary intelligence, including the lunar and solar instrumentalities. It's synchromysticism, the Planetary Tantra is synchromysticism based on interactivity with the planetary entelechy, the planetary intelligence. And so again, to quote that definition, it's not a matter of a relationship between the collective consciousness of all sentient beings on Earth. Quote, no, it's the relationship between the collective consciousness of all sentient beings and the Earth. Therefore, it begins, synchromysticism in Planetary Tantra begins with a relationship. And everything coheres around that relationship, and the sacred narrative frames the exploration and implementation of whatever psychic and occult powers may be discovered along the path of synchromysticism. I've been wanting to comment on that topic for a while now, couple of years, actually. So, lo and behold, I finally got it out. Now let me proceed to the core material of this briefing. I'd like to start with a thought that came to my mind the other day as I was driving back from the little white village near where I live. I asked myself, or myself asked me, what if the events that unfold in correction are more dramatic and spectacular than we can even now anticipate? Or to put the thought in another way, but also posed as a question, how dramatic and spectacular could the events of correction be if they played out lavishly in the theater of collective events? Now, just hold those questions in your mind for a moment. Let them float while I reiterate the foundational premise of this experiment, the GNE. Remember that this experiment refers back to the notion of correction, diorthosis, found in Gnostic writings. Correction, I interpret to mean the moment in the experiment on Earth when the Aeon Sophia herself intervenes from within the experiment to reset the experiment. Now, according to the usual procedure of the Aeons, and I base what I'm saying now on a long study and evaluation of kalpas and yugas and time cycles found in the Hindu and Brahminical tradition. What the Aeons normally do is reset an experiment according to the timing of the stars, according to the timing of the celestial clock. The equivalence of 1 day of Aeonic time to 25,920 years is a verifiable and testifiable correspondence. Just as in any other experiment that human scientists would conduct, the process of checking the experiment has to be done systematically. Even, say, if you're growing peas, or if you're trying to produce some new hybrid of peas, then you set up the experiment and you let it develop and you go check it at predetermined intervals of time. And this is an important component of any experiment. You might check it after a day, after every 2 hours, or every 2 days, or every 2 months. And then you would determine at the time of checking if the initial conditions of the experiment need to be changed so that the experiment can proceed in the optimal fashion. So this is all quite logical and quite scientific. I apply this kind of thinking to the divine experiment of the Anthropos on planet Earth. Normally, the Aeon Sophia would wait until the end of the Kalpa, that is 2216 by our calendar time, and then reset the experiment for the next Kalpa. Due to the anomalous circumstances of this experiment, however, with Sophia herself present in material imminence, alive in the planet, animated and animating, well, due to those conditions, she has the option to reset the experiment before the midnight hour in cosmic time. The purpose of the GNE is to follow that reset process. So I have used the term the 3 years of initialization of the conditions for correction, or the 3 years of setting the initial conditions for correction, right? But I could just as well use the word reset. The 3 years define the period of reset. And correction itself actually begins around the spring equinox, March 2014, after the reset has been established. Now, I know that those of you who follow the GNE are fully aware of what I just said, but it does help to restate it from time to time. And I'm restating it right now for a particular reason. I want to refer to an archontic analogy. Installing new programs or upgrading an operating system in a computer. Suppose that you have an update of your operating system. And contained in that update, that is not just an improvement of the current operating system, but contained or comprised in that update are new applications or improved applications. Now, applications in computer lingo are the programs that you run as tools of the operating system. The operating system itself runs applications, and you use those applications as tools to do things. For instance, Photoshop is an application. Word is an application. WordPerfect is a word processing program that I initially used when I first started working with a computer. Entourage is an application. There are hundreds and hundreds and thousands of applications. Now, let's suppose that we are in the process of updating the operating system in the master computer we're using. And so we stop using the system to do anything. We stop using the tools of the system, which are the applications, while the system is being upgraded and while those tools are being improved or new tools are added. And this is, of course, the reset or rebooting process. So, obviously, during the time that the installation and updating occurs, installation of the new programs and updating occurs, and the rebooting occurs, cannot use the operating system to do anything. But we can anticipate all the wonderful things that we're going to do when the system is rebooted and reset. Well, this is exactly the situation we're facing with the GNE. During the 3-year period from March 2011 to March 2014, you might want to do some things that you consider to be practical and visionary applications of the Sophianic method, or I should say the Telestic method and the Sophianic message of Gnosticism. During those 3 years, it's natural that our minds would be at moments literally throbbing and flashing with the possibilities and opportunities to apply planetary tantra in correction. But the fact of the matter is that nothing can be done during the 3 years while the rebooting process is underway. Suppose, for instance, that in the operating system we are upgrading, there is a new version of Photo Booth or some design application. So we're thinking about how we could use this improved version to construct an interactive model of the Shakti cluster. How beautiful that would be. There would be the Shakti cluster in its oval form with its central inverted pentagram and the positions of the Mahavidyas around the oval. All of the structural elements of the Shakti cluster could be represented in a graphic design which could be modular. It could be taken apart and looked at from various angles. All the properties of the Shakti cluster could be accessible through click-on programs. For instance, you could go and click one of the buttons on the perimeter of the oval, and it would bring up, if it was the button corresponding, say, to Chinnamasta or Mirita, it would bring up material on Chinnamasta. It would show you the traditional Hindu imagery. It would link to another page that would give you the current translation and the current syntax for that Mahavidya. It would link back to a master calendar, which would list the Marita cycles and so forth and so on. Well, how exciting is this? Here we have a way of using the archonic technology by the application of a tool, a design tool, to produce an interactive teaching model of the Shakti cluster, and from there to go directly into the interactive magic that can be performed with the Shakti cluster. All of that is conceivable, brilliantly conceivable, in these 3 years, but it is not doable in the 3 years. Nothing really concrete is doable in the 3 years for the simple reason that I've just said. You can't use the applications and upgraded features of a system while the system is being reset. Clear enough? The same restriction on what is doable in these 3 years could be applied, say, to the Calico War Party. The Calico War Party is actually a paradigm that emerges during the reset period of 3 years. And as reset proceeds, the formation of the Kalika War Party comes to be defined. So far, there are 5 ranks that have been loosely and roughly defined. It would be my intention that by March of 2014, the entire Thunderbird configuration of the Kalika War Party would be defined. And from that moment on, when correction begins, then the Kalika War Party could go into action. So I could use many other examples of this. The point that I'm making is that there is an excruciating process of anticipation and preparation required to carry off this experiment successfully. And as much as I myself would like to bring forth certain elements of Planetary Tantra during these 3 years, or to demonstrate, for instance, the method of interactive magic or the use of the Shakti cluster as a tool of Gayan Tantric magic, I really cannot do so while the reset is underway. Well, no problem there, my friends, because even without implementing and manifesting the possibilities that are dawning now to those of us engaged in Planetary Tantra, even without that, you have to say we really got our hands full with the GNE. This experiment is a huge challenge, because it requires that we be occupied intensely with certain matters during the 3 years of reset. What are those matters? Well, primarily they are of two kinds. The first is to follow the process of reset itself as closely as is humanly possible. That is to say, to monitor the reset through the operations of the first and second attention of the Wisdom Goddess, as indicated by the apogee and perigee surges, and to decode the events in the human endopsyche corresponding to reset, as they may be reflected in the constellations and in certain planetary movements and patterns. Okay, so there you are. That is the challenge of monitoring reset in real time. But that's only half of what is entailed in the GNE. At the same time, during the same 3 years, we're engaged in a process of review, recapitulation, and extrapolation of the Sophianic myth itself. FGS 2.0, FGS 3.0, at the inception of correction, it all comes to FGS 4.0. And so while we're living in real time and monitoring the reset, we are also engaged in an attempt to look back at the myth and to see the current catastrophe facing humanity, which could be also regarded as a magnificent opportunity, and I do regard it as such, to see the current challenge facing the human species in the perspective of the myth. So we have added elements to the myth in these 3 years. We have elaborated and extrapolated it, most notably by including the factor of pleromic relay. So you see, this is an enormous task. This is one hell of a challenge. Just to stay on board during the reset process. Also, I would have you bear in mind that you are in turbulence, psychic turbulence, and also existential turbulence when you engage Planetary Tantra and the Shakti Cluster. And that is to say that the power of this connection to the Aeons of Vaya destabilizes your life. And so the conditions, especially during these 3 years, the conditions of your personal and existential life are also bound to be precarious, turbulent, and unstable. And while you may feel compelled and inspired, indeed, and rightly so, to initiate projects or to undertake new relationships or to set up networks with people during these 3 years, the conditions for doing so will be highly challenging because these are precarious and turbulent times, and these 3 years are perhaps the most precarious and turbulent moment that you will undergo in your entire life. So, in this perspective, you can see the two main preoccupations, the two main occupations of the GNE, which are monitoring reset in real time and reviewing and enriching and extrapolating the Sophianic vision story. Well, in addition to that, there is a third factor, which is, of course, anticipating what is to come. During the time that we observed the lunar perigees moving through the scales, it was possible to detect in the outer world a number of developments in the global financial system that reflected those moments. So we could speak at that time of a resetting of the scales, and that indeed has been underway. And so in correction, we may expect or anticipate the consequences of that resetting. To some degree, the resetting is simply a change of perception. If more and more people in the world could perceive the way that the financial system operates, for instance, through the fraud of fractional reserve banking, then, and through the fraud of issuance of currency as debt by a global financial mafia, well, obviously, that perception would change the way that people operate in the world, and it would impel people forcefully to change the entire financial system. First comes the perception of what is wrong, the perception of what has to be reset. Then comes the reset process, and then comes the consequences and results of the reset process. And I would venture to say that we're certainly seeing that play out in the realm of global finances over these 3 years. Now, if I focus in the remaining half hour of this briefing on what we can expect or what we can anticipate when correction begins, then it will bring us around to the main theme of the briefing, which is the will to avenge. You know, I've said that the battle for sanity and survival on this planet is a battle for the narrative. Of course, I'm not the only person who's said that. And you only have to take the case of 9/11 to exemplify the imperative significance of that statement. There is an official narrative of 9/11 and what happened, and then there are other narratives. And what the world has seen over the last 13 years is a battle over the narrative, which narrative is true. I have said that the mainstream of the ruling narrative of deceit upon this planet is the Jewish Holocaust legend, and I propose that we could anticipate a breakdown of that legend, a refutation of it, and a challenge of it to come into high prominence in correction. Well, I think that I can safely say, confidently, that over these last 3 years, and in fact, just within the last 3 or 4 months since the decisive turnaround of the chess game in the Middle East, there is every day escalating pushback and blowback against the Jewish narrative of the Holocaust and the current Jewish-Israeli Zadokite narrative regarding the role of Israel in world affairs. So what you can see in the 3 years reset period are the initial conditions that are going to lead to the complete and total discrediting and refuting of that Holocaust legend as it has been foisted upon the world through Hollywood and through other fictitious and specious instruments of disinformation and deceit. Nevertheless, I would say that, and you might agree with me, that the battle for the narrative is a very tough uphill battle fought on pretty low odds. It's not easy to convince just one individual even to reconsider the Holocaust scenario in its official or accepted form. It is not easy to get people to take the time, scrutiny, and care to look into the 9/11 narrative and break it down and deconstruct it in the attempt to get to some kind of true perception about what happened. So I put it to you now that although I anticipate massive changes in the battle for the narrative, I am not sure that that would be the decisive factor for human participation in correction. It involves historical relearning, it involves scrutiny, research, thinking through things, it involves a lot of discussion, a lot of evaluation of evidence in order to deconstruct specious and deceptive narratives and arrive at an accurate and reliable narrative of our social history. And I don't expect that initiative, that challenge, to be undertaken by so many people. So the question that came to my mind recently went something like this. It defined itself something like this. Yes, breaking through to a narrative of truth is essential in correction, but what if that is not the single and crucial breakpoint? Because it is intellectual, because it requires scrutiny and evaluation and discernment, it may in fact be beyond the intellectual capacity of a great many people. So I'm asking myself, could there be another event on the mass scale to anticipate as correction dawns? Could there be a key event, a focal or crucial event, that would in some manner mobilize human intention toward correction, even among those who do not have the concept of correction operating in their minds and lives? What kind of event would that be? Well, I propose the word empathy. Changing the narrative is a matter of scrutiny and discernment. It involves a serious intellectual engagement, let's face it. But what about the power of empathy? The power of empathy moves human animals more vastly and more compellingly than arguments and persuasions, especially if they are intellectual or historical, especially intellectual and historical revisionism and review. This is not everybody's cup of tea. So could there be, in addition to the breakthrough, the breakaway from the lying narrative, could there be, additionally, an empathic breakthrough that happens at the dawn of correction, that somehow brings the hearts and minds of human animals to a single focus, and therefore gives power to correction? What would that focus be? What might that focus be? Well, I ask you to return to the page of the Navigator Briefings and click on the poster of Kali Ma, coming soon to a theater near you. Now look at the two statements presented at the top of the poster, each one stated in two lines. Hurt the mother, the wounds she'll take, but hurt the child, and Kali awakes. Now let's consider the proposition inherent to the first two lines for a moment. What does it suggest to you? Wounding the mother. Well, who is the mother? The mother is the planet Earth, the planetary animal mother, Gaia, or Gaia Sophia. Kali represents the rage of the animal mother, which is rage on a planetary scale. So the mother is wounded, but she takes the wounds. What does that suggest? Well, I'm a creature of the 60s generation. I hit the ground running in 1960 when I turned 15 years old. I think Rachel Carson's book, The Silent Spring, came out in the 60s. At the same time, of course, that the psychedelic revolution was dawning. So I remember very clearly what it was like to be on the ground and in the front lines when the first brigades of ecological warriors appeared. Eco-warriors in defense of the Earth, those who proclaimed that we must stop looting, raping, and pillaging the natural world and inflicting wounds upon the mother, which is our very habitat. I remember those warnings. I remember that wave of ecological protest and the empathy it inspired. You only have to go back and look at history over these 50 years now, since the mid-60s, and look at the ecological movement, or what you might call the eco-warrior front. And you have only to look at that and see that the power of that movement depends upon the way that it focuses human empathy upon the issue of wounding the earth, harming the earth, polluting and destroying the environment. Now that's an issue everybody can agree upon. To protect the earth, our habitat, to protect the soil itself, the very soil in which food grows, and the precious plants that produce food, and the bees. This is the mission of the Eco Warriors, which continues to this day, and I have only gratitude and praise for those who are at the forefront of this mission. Only gratitude and praise. That is all I allow to come out of my mouth. So I would ask you to align with me at this moment in confirming that ecology and the war to protect the earth and heal the wounded earth is a tremendous point of empathic focus for the entire human species. Agreed? But what if that focus alone is not enough to make up the component of human participation in correction? And I mean the collective planet scale component. What if that single focus is not enough? What if a second focus would be required? Now look again at the poster and see what the second line says. But hurt the child and Kali awakes. Hurt the child. What is this illusion? Who is the child? And what kind of hurt are we talking about here? Well, let's go back again to the 60s for a moment, if you'll allow me, if you'll indulge me, to draw upon my own personal history. After all, it is all I have to go on. I only have the authenticity of my own experience. Something else that emerged in the 60s into brilliant definition was called the human potential movement. I've often cited Abraham Maslow. For instance, in Quest for the Zodiac, Maslow's fourth psychology plays a key role in defining the astrology of the future. The human potential movement was a tremendous breakthrough in the 1960s, a breakthrough for the entire planet, led by such people as Stan Grof, who is still charging ahead today. He's like the locomotive who won't be stopped. There were various facets to the human potential movement, and indeed some of those facets were appropriated, subverted, and hijacked by the CIA and by other governmental agencies who were attempting to take advantage of this tremendous breakthrough and turn it to the profit of their deceptions and their control system. Nevertheless, I think the record of the human potential movement in its purity and integrity is impressive. And one of the things that grew out of the human potential movement, or merged with it, I should say, and produced again a secondary or spin-off movement, was Alcoholics Anonymous. So in the 70s and in the 80s, when Alcoholics Anonymous combined with the human potential movement, the result was a massive spread of 12-step recovery movements, such as Overeaters Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, Sex Addicts Anonymous. Al-Anon, of course, had been the first one. ACA, Adult Children Anonymous, and ACOA, Adult Children of Alcoholics. I myself participated in the ACA movement, as I described in a previous briefing, Adult Children Anonymous. What united all these movements, or many of these alternative movements in the 12-step recovery program, was the concept of child abuse. So child abuse became a massively charged meme, if you will, a massively charged topic or subject building through the 1970s into the 1980s when the recovery movement peaked. I was fortunate enough to be there at the moment that it peaked. I am forever grateful for the hours and hours and hundreds of meetings that I spent in those rooms, anonymously spilling my guts to other people. And to the extent that I can stand today as an honest and transparent human animal before others, if they wish to look upon me in that way, I can do it because of those rooms, because of that recovery movement. Unfortunately, I know many others who were not able to benefit from that movement, who are still today hampered and crippled in their personal psychology and in their ability to be honest with themselves. I would say, speaking today, that it is an irrefutable fact that the recovery movement of those decades was a tremendous focus of collective empathy across this planet. And what focused the empathy of every single person who sat in those rooms with me, time and time again, without judgment and without analysis, but simply bearing our souls and revealing the grief that had been done to us in childhood. What focused us all, no matter our differences, was the theme and cause of child abuse. But I must say that at that time, going on 20 to 25 years ago now, the concept of child abuse that we regarded and that we constantly reviewed and discussed and to which we were witnesses from the testimony of our personal experiences in childhood, that concept was limited to a very narrow definition. That is to say, the child abuse that children undergo in their families. It was limited to the family context. And whether it was mental, verbal, physical, or sexual abuse, when we discussed abuse, and when we bravely described to complete strangers in lurid detail the abuse to which we had been subjected, we were talking about a very limited concept of child abuse. Now, I want to propose to you that as we come up to the dawn of correction, there is another concept of child abuse that comes into view. Now, the timing of this is significant, and I've investigated this timing. What I'm going to tell you now is based on an investigation of my reading of the historical events in parallel to the celestial writing. It's not just an arbitrary happenstance that the issue of child abuse would return in 2014 to be again a focus of massive collective empathy. If I'm on the right track here, and if I'm reading the signals correctly and correlating them correctly with the historical and social trends, then this is indeed the moment when the concept of child abuse reappears, but now amplified into something rather different than it was back in my day in the recovery movement. And what would that amplification be? That amplification would be the expanded definition of child abuse above and beyond the family setting. The definition of child abuse that encompasses a systematic and massive network of pedophiliac abduction, murder, and torture, and child pornography, including snuff films. Now we're talking child abuse. Now we're talking harm to the child. You don't have to glorify the child even to the level of the anthropos. Regardless of whether you consider the child, each child, to be the bearer of the anthropos, things of a horrific and gruesome nature are being done to children today all over the world, and they are being done systematically through agents operating in a system of organized torture, murder, and pornographic exploitation of children. And I'm going to call this the global satanic network of child abuse. I didn't have any idea back in the recovery rooms in Santa Fe in 1986 and 1987 that anything like a global network of satanic child abuse, including torture and snuff films, existed. But today I am well aware of that fact, and there is a growing research that supports that. Go look at the work of Ted Gunderson. Go look at the work of Brian Gerrish, G-E-R-R-I-S-H, who has the YouTube channel UK Column. One of the points that Brian Gerrish makes is not only does this network exist, that it's highly organized and highly systematic, and that there is a vast body of evidence pointing to this network. But there are two other factors that you must bear in mind once you take on board, once you allow yourself to even think about such a thing existing in this world. There are two other factors you need to take on board right away. And Brian Gerrish continually underlines and emphasizes these two factors. The first is that there is a massive, systematic conspiracy of cover-up against this satanic network of child abuse. The force that goes into organizing and maintaining the network is equaled by the force of intimidation and extortion that goes into covering it up. And the second point that Brian Gerrish makes, and he makes it brilliantly, is that this network of satanic child abuse is the system of control of politics at the executive level. Now, it's one thing to affirm, as more and more people are doing on the internet, the power of the Jewish lobby in the United States. And it's one thing to affirm the power of money in buying people out. And I wouldn't be the first one to say that the entire American Congress has been bought out and bought off by the Jewish lobby and AIPAC. A whole book has been written on this recently. There are countless people on the internet arguing this point. Well, yes, you can control people through money. You can buy them out. People are corruptible in that way. But what Brian Gerrish points out is that the master system of control, the master technique, is blackmail and extortion. And so the network of satanic child abuse, murder, torture, and pornographic exploitation of children is not merely there for the satisfaction of the perverts whom it serves, but it is there for a much larger purpose. A larger and encompassing purpose as a tool to exploit, extort, and blackmail people in positions of power. And that is how the most evil people on this planet retain control of those who are in positions socially and politically to decide the course of human affairs. And this is a very great fact, and it is a very great, gruesome, horrible, and dirty fact. And it is my highest wish that this gruesome, horrible, and dirty fact should become known in 2014. I introduce this theme now to you at this point in these briefings, and I intend to continue to develop it in the briefings to come down to March of this year. I introduce you to you for your consideration only the notion that behind the political corruption of this world, there is a deep form of evil that actually presents the control mechanism of that corruption. That is the global network of satanic child abuse. And I ask you to consider, I know it's not easy and I know it's not pretty, but I ask you to consider that the cause of the child who and the children who are massively victimized by the system might be the decisive factor to focus collective empathy in correction. I ask you to consider that. I ask you to go back again and look at the words on the poster with my slight modification. Hurt the mother and the wounds she can take, but hurt the child and see Kali awake. You know, maybe you've wondered, as I have, I'm sure you've wondered, certainly you've expressed it to me in emails, why doesn't Gaia respond? What's going on? When is she going to wake up? When is the planetary animal mother herself going to take out her rage on the perpetrators? Look at what's being done to her. Look at Fukushima. The wound inflicted upon the planet by Fukushima is unimaginable in its horror and in its magnitude, isn't it? That event happened at the beginning of reset. What is she doing? What is the planetary animal mother doing to counteract Fukushima? How come the animal mother doesn't turn in rage upon those who are wounding her? Well, maybe the wounds inflicted upon her are not what is required. They are not all that is required. But hurt the child and see how Kali awakes. I, like you, have wondered why the Earth hasn't awakened, why she doesn't bring the power of her rage, which is Kali, in full brunt against the perpetrators. But I want to tell you this loud and clear, Mimedes, in concluding this briefing. There are certain things that she can only do with a measure of human collaboration. The rage of Gaia, which is Kali, requires human instruments. It requires flesh and blood people as instruments of that rage. And in order for large numbers of people to express that rage and turn it upon the targets that are the right targets, to direct it with elucidated anger upon the right targets, in order for that to happen in any large-scale manner in the collective sphere of life, there must be a focal point of massive empathy. How would we know if I am correct here? How would we know if I am going in the right direction? Well, I'd like to pick up this theme a few more times in the future and show you how I arrived at this topic. I'd like to show you, through my decoding of the celestial writing and the timing of the apogee and perigee surges in the reset, how I came to determine that this would be the crucial issue. This is the tipping point issue that goes above and beyond all other issues. Child abuse perpetrated in the network of satanic child torture is the ultimate focal point of human empathy. I think it must be. I ask you to consider if it could be so. So please consider it carefully. And if you can, try to hold this topic steadily in your mind for the remaining 3 months of the GNE. What does all this have to do with what I'm calling the will to avenge? Well, I think I might be able to explain that in the last few minutes of this briefing by putting it in first-person language, and you can relate to it as you will. The battle for controlling the narrative is rather like the battle for controlling what people say about me or you. But since I'm talking in the first person, I'll talk about myself. There's a narrative around every person in the world, and there's a narrative around me. That is to say, the story of what I do, the story of how I act. And so, in the battle for the narrative, what am I doing? Well, honestly, folks, I'm just trying to stand on my two feet, be naked and transparent, and stick to the truth of facts and acts, without the distortion of accusations, suppositions, and lies. Nevertheless, I've had the experience in my life when people lie to me and when they lie about me. Now, when that happens, I like to do something about it. And so I do the best I can to correct the lie. How do I do that? I simply stand forth in honesty and transparency and tell the truth as I know it. Tell my side of the story, and I stand against the lies that are told to me or about me. But get this, really get this distinction. In stating my truth and in referring to the real facts and the real acts that occurred in a situation, I attempt to hold my ground and stand on my truth against whatever narrative may be constructed around me. And if someone lies about me, I'm not particularly inspired to attack them. Likewise, for instance, I wrote a film about Sabina Spielrein, but before that film could be made into a movie, someone else made another movie about it, which is full of lies. It is a sick and distorted narrative. But I don't feel compelled to attack David Cronenberg and the other people who made that film, because when I respond to lies, I simply refute the lies, and I count on the truth standing for itself. People take sides in situations. They take sides with one narrative or another, say regarding yours truly, John Lash. I don't care who takes sides. Try taking sides with the truth. That's all I care about. And the truth is not always easy to determine. But in these battles for the narrative, whether they be a narrative about myself personally, John did this, John did that, or whether they be a narrative about 9/11 or the so-called Holocaust, there is in human nature no particular compulsion to attack. If you lie to me or lie about me, I won't attack you. I have no will to avenge. I only have the desire to correct. But hurt me, and you will see the will to avenge. When someone hurts me, I feel like hurting them back, and I do hurt them back. If someone hurts me physically, I will hurt them back more than they hurt me. If someone hurts me emotionally and verbally, I will hurt them back more than they hurt me, more intensely and more brutally. And I do brutalize people verbally who hurt me with their words. I do that, and that comes from what I call the will to avenge. And I would like to propose to you that you consider that the will to avenge is a natural component in the human psyche, that it is healthy, and that it is necessary for survival in the human world. But what inspires or compels the will to avenge in a human animal? Well, I can speak for my own personal case, as I just did. But now, If you will, if you can, I would ask you to take that personal illustration and extrapolate it to the collective case. Expand it and extrapolate it into the universal. I conclude this briefing by asking you this question. What kind of hurt has to be inflicted upon human beings in this world for there to be a massive empathic reaction in the collective, such that it would inspire the will to avenge? That is the question of the moment, of this historical moment, in my humble consideration. And I leave you now with that question, and I ask you to consider it with all the compassion, sobriety, and ruthlessness that you can find in your human soul.